Thank you. What I have in by way of conclusion is just a brief, you might say, Thomistic exhortation to you. When I thought about the youth and intellectual talent and energy in this room, I thought I should finish with something which would be hopeful and more exhortative. Contemporary secular liberalism seems to many of us, and rightly so, culturally monolithic. It's not only politically powerful in terms of the institutions of our governance, in its extremely secular format even, but it's also intensively present in academic institutions in ways we've just been discussing, and increasingly, if steadily, manifest in our corporate culture as major economic institutions in the private sector fall all over one another to testify to their secular liberal cosmopolitan bona fides. But contemporary secular liberalism is also marked in its inner sanctum, that's to say in its theoretical core, by profound and possibly insurmountable forms of incoherence. The scientific atheism of thinkers like Steven Pinker, Daniel Dennett, and Richard Dawkins aspires to provide us with a new secular metaphysics, an explanation of reality that is materialistic, naturalistic, and sanitized of all religious belief. But it's not one that leaves much room for any thick conception of real human freedom, or for the modern sense of the autonomous free self and its rights, or its meaningful appetites for happiness and meaning. In fact, modern materialism could be said to evacuate the modern liberal freedom of autonomy that stands at the heart of the modern rights project, from Immanuel Kant to John Rawls and others who associate with them. Nor is it clear from a purely empirical point of view, supposedly championed by the scientistic, what human equality might really consist in, or what equal rights between the sexes could be, just by quantitative mathematical measures allied with modern scientific measurements, or what equality might be among people of differing cultural or racial backgrounds. So this egalitarian, rights-based form of liberalism, which is at the heart of our political culture, isn't well safeguarded by the contemporary thin metaphysics of scientism. At the same time, it itself traditionally suspends commitments to aggressive and deep attempts to explain its own metaphysical roots. The most evident and powerful example remains the First Critique of Immanuel Kant, where there's the suspension of any protracted attempt to show the deep metaphysical roots of human nature or human personhood or dignity in something pertaining to human nature and open in itself to the transcendent reference to God as known naturally. So Thomas might ask whether both in its scientific instantiations and its maybe classical liberal instantiations, liberalism lacks real grit and foundations to justify some of its deep political ambitions. But in asking that question, Thomas wouldn't be alone, because Friedrich Nietzsche also stands at the door and knocks. The modern liberal project of a rights ethics evacuated of metaphysical foundations is not easily reconciled with the modern post-structuralist project of Friedrich Nietzsche or Michel Foucault or Vadimo. These anti-metaphysicians, or if you might say anti-classical metaphysicians, seek to undermine what they take to be the myths of modern liberalism, including very much, in Nietzsche's case, that of Kant's egalitarianism, which can be perceived as the burning embers of a faded Christian ontology from the past, not yet crushed by the realization that there never was a basis for political liberalism in nature, since there never was a basis there for the modern liberal self and its appeal to universal dignity, equality, and human rights. Thus Nietzsche, at least as I'm interpreting him. So today, between these three deeply influential cultural modes of discourse that inhabit our secular universities, that's to say between the scientific positivists, the Rawlsian liberals, and the postmodern genealogists, there exists a kind of unstated, or I would say under-scrutinized, detente, a gentleman's agreement to work practically along united lines in view of secular post-Christian ends. but motivated by very fundamentally different and in many ways incompatible ideas. And that is a weakness. Because ultimately, practical thought and even political work are based on something more than useful outcomes shared among people with very diverse viewpoints. Practical truths are grounded more fundamentally in speculative or theoretical visions. And vision always wins out in the end. Christianity has survived its many competitors over the centuries, not uniquely, but in part due to its high speculative truth claims, or you might say, to use a different space metaphor, its depth of vision, its non-reductive understanding of the human person, the Christian philosophy and ethics that have motivated it as a movement for centuries. But Christianity doesn't just bury its enemies. It also prays for them, speaks to them, has mercy on them, and talks to them as friends. It's interesting in this respect to think about, in terms of our relationship with politics more generally and liberalism, a question in the Summa Theologiae, where Aquinas asks about the new law. Why is it a law? And he quotes Augustine, who says of the Torah and the old law, citing St. Paul, that the spirit gives life, but the letter kills. And so he asks, is this also the case in the new law? And he says, I distinguish. In certain sense, yes. Basically, when he asks what the new law is that should animate human society, Aquinas says, it is the gift of the Holy Spirit lived in abundance. It is the transformative power of grace and love and truth poured into the human heart that allow human beings to live dynamically as sons and daughters of God, as friends of Christ, and that animates human culture from within, in the deepest embers of the human spirit. Then he says, now this also requires that there are external manifestations of the truth of the Spirit's life in us by moral law and theoretical doctrine. And if we fall back on the external manifestations of church life that are these instruments of reason, that are the expressions of law and theoretical doctrine, alone without the Spirit, then the letter kills. But if we try to live in the Spirit without the law and the instruments of theoretical doctrine, then our love will not be structured and will ultimately also perish from a lack of determination by reference to the truth. Now, why I mention that is the following reason. It suggests that the human spirit naturally, with regards to politics, cannot find its ultimate solutions as to its own inner meaning, because those meaning, that most ultimate inner meaning, is found through the gift and life of grace. However, here we should make a distinction. Nature must be, for Aquinas, at least sufficiently underdetermined that it leaves room for life in the spirit, which means, concretely, it's wrong to look for a political solution that's so naturalistic that it doesn't leave room for a higher salvation. If you think politics does all the work, you have a problem in Christianity. At the same time, you don't want to leave man so underdetermined that his nature isn't already political, and that there isn't some political natural integrity to him so that he can be open to political transformation. Said in shorthand, grace presupposes nature. Well, where am I going with all this? I'm obviously excluding the idea that a right organization of Christian politics can solve the problems of the human race. But I'm also excluding the idea that Christians shouldn't or could somehow absent themselves from the promotion of a sound Christian philosophy of human politics. And in that latter vein, I think that today what is needed is a thick, dense, profound Christian understanding, philosophical Christian understanding, of human freedom, human rights, and human ends. One that is grounded in classical Christian theological and philosophical traditions and expressed publicly, as such, without apologies. Those other groups out there aren't dominating. Nature abhors a vacuum, but we live in a cultural vacuum. There's a vacuum of explanation. And no one group that's out there, be it secular or religionist, seems to have some evident dominance in the theoretical market. So we should express ourselves without dissimulation, with clarity, with charity, and with depth, and try to win the argument. That's a very Christian thing to do, to promote the truth publicly, by preaching, by teaching, by speaking. What we need then is to express a Christian sense of liberty balanced by a strong sense of the common good, a commitment to a deep understanding of human nature, and the religious orientation of human thought, which should be defended as a truth of public reason, and the rationality of belief in the existence of God and of the human assent to God as part of the structure of human spirit, as well as the rationality of being open to divine revelation. This deeper vision of human liberty should be one that takes into account autonomy and rights, the place of human conscience, but also purposes, the virtues and vices that qualify human freedom and create character, and the relationship between character and happiness, and the end for which the rights exist, the life of communion in society under the auspices of the common good. But also that political life should be about this, the public and communal pursuit of the truth about the nature of things, including the truth about God and the truth about Christ, which must, if it's to be truly universal, have a place in the university. It is interesting that Christ says in the Gospel of St. John, "Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." The truth will set you free. Perhaps we might comment on the words of our Lord in this way: "You cannot love what you do not know, but if you come to know what is of ultimate significance, you can also in turn come to love it, and by loving it, in a certain sense, possess it, frequent with it, live with it." What is the truth we might live with that would set us free for that higher good? Well, Christ is speaking, of course, about the Father, the truth about the Father, about himself, and about the Spirit of truth. To come to know God is to be set free to love what is ultimate, what endures, what is real, what can liberate the inner person by giving us what alone may ultimately fulfill us in our native and ineradicable desires for peace, happiness, and perspective. This ultimate truth, however, does not destroy, but instead magnifies the other truths that set us free. God is not the enemy of human dignity. The recognition of the reality of God magnifies the truth of human dignity, but also the centrality of the common good of life and society, the virtues of the human person, the rights of the individual, the dignity of the human conscience, the importance of the family, the joy of life and society. That is a coherent vision of Christian liberty and of social polity. It is a kind of coherent vision we need to strive to articulate and to communicate to our fellow citizens, our friends, including our secular liberal friends, and indeed even to those who mistakenly count themselves as the enemies of the faith. So then, to conclude, I suggest, by way of exhortation, the truth, veritas, will set us free, and that is a good motto for the Christian living in the age of liberalism, set free to know the truth, to live for the truth, and to publicly proclaim the truth, and even, and most especially perhaps, to live the truth. May that be our true aim, our work, and our prayer. Thank you very much for attending the conference. It's been great to have you here, and we look forward to seeing you at further events.